Good evening, lovelies. Welcome to another episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. Tonight, as millions of Americans across the nation sit down in front of their television sets to watch two teams face off in what some would consider the ultimate American championship, I thought tonight would be the perfect time to maybe learn a little bit more about American history. And we're going to do that tonight with author Philip Goodrich. He has a new book called Somerset, and it will open your eyes and your mind to some historical facts and data that I had no clue about, and I was overjoyed to actually learn about. This episode is brought to you by Newsly. Newsly is a hot new news app that brings all of the hot trending topics and stories of the day and puts them all in one place where it's easy to listen to. That's right, listen to. Newsly has made the internet not only searchable, but listenable. So stop scrolling, stop searching, stop getting aggravated that you have to purchase a subscription to read the rest of the story, and start Newsly-ing. You can head over to newsly.me. Use my promo code CCC2022 for a free 1 month premium subscription. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite beverage, cuddle up with your host pup, go Bengals, and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the show. I am here with Philip Goodrich. He is the author of Somerset, or Why and How Benjamin Franklin Orchestrated the American Revolution. So your book puts forth or tells how Benjamin Franklin started the revolution off, or kicked it off, which is, I'm not a history buff. I'm not that knowledgeable about it. So take me into it a little bit, just a little background on what we're talking about here, okay?
Sure, be happy to. Benjamin Franklin, we're all familiar with his name and we're kind of familiar with his background, but I think for centuries now we've been scratching our heads as to why he was considered a founding father. I mean, what's he doing on the $100 bill? All of these things. I think they're legitimate questions. As it turns out, Benjamin Franklin was very much a promoter of Pennsylvania and specifically Philadelphia. He turned Philadelphia into the second largest city in the British Empire by 1760. And that's a little known statistic that is verifiable. And except for London, Philadelphia was it. It was because of Benjamin Franklin. At any rate, he had witnessed Pennsylvania surviving two wars and was concerned that one more war and Philadelphia was going to end up getting torched. And so he went to London seeking help for the defense of Pennsylvania. At that time, Pennsylvania was operated by a single family, the Penn family, the descendants of William Penn. And they were extracting as much profit out of the organization as they could. They were like corporate raiders. They were, how much money can we extract out of this colony? And Franklin, of course, was irate over this. And he said, we're at threat constantly from indigenous people in the western part of Pennsylvania, as well as potential invaders from either France or Spain. And we need defense. Mm-hmm. Much said, not only are we not going to help you, but if you spend a nickel of your own money providing weapons for settlers, we will consider that an act of treason. So he was certain that if he discussed this with either the British Crown or with British Parliament, they would say, oh, you're right, Ben, you win, we're going to take Pennsylvania away from the Penn family. So he went to London to do that, and both Parliament and the Crown said, we're good with the Penn family doing this. Go away. So at that point, he starts pursuing other mechanisms whereby Pennsylvania can get separated from the British Empire. And friends in London that knew better than Benjamin Franklin did said, you can't do that. You're going to have to either get all the colonies enlisted in this or just drop it. And I think they were hoping he would just drop it. But being Benjamin Franklin, no, I'm not going to drop it. Enlist 12 other colonies if that's what it takes. So that's what he did. And the question for the last 250 years is, how do you enlist 12 other colonies at that time in North America in wanting to rebel against the British Empire? Well, for the states like Massachusetts and New York, it was pretty easy because by that time the British government was quartering soldiers in their cities, both in New York and Boston. And with the Boston Massacre, they showed that they were there not to provide defense for Boston, but to keep the colonists from misbehaving. And they were there pretty much as a police force. And so the great source of distress, both in New York and Boston. But in the American South, they were almost all loyalist. There were no big cities there. There were no fights over taxation. There were no violent protests anywhere. And so Franklin's colleagues in London, and particularly in Edinburgh, Scotland, assured him that the only way he was going to get the southern colonies involved in this was he was going to have to come up with a different reason to get them involved. And with discussions with his friends, both in London and Edinburgh, the thing they hit upon is, what would happen if the British Empire started freeing American black slaves? And Franklin, of course, immediately jumped on that. Oh, that would do it. Mm-hmm. At that point, it would threaten their existence. It would threaten their livelihood. It would threaten their lands, their families, their own lives, because they were constantly, by that time, fearful of slave uprisings and slave rebellions. They've been through this already in the early 18th century, and it was a constant source of heartburn for the slave owners in the American South. So Franklin knew, yeah, if we can make that happen, but he didn't see any way that that could happen. Well, guess what? There was already an early abolitionist in London named Granville Sharp who was working just to that end. He simply wanted to free a single black American enslaved person, because he felt that if he could prove that black African enslaved persons had rights equal to that of other Brits, that should in and of itself abolish slavery. And that was Bill Sharp's stance. So he had to find one case where the courts would have to agree with him and say, yeah, this person has to be set free. That's where we get to Somerset versus Stuart. And that's really the source of the entire enterprise then for Franklin. Without the six southern colonies, he can't get this done. Without the freeing of an enslaved American of black ancestry, he can't get this done. So how can I make this happen? There's your story.
And this is 1772.
And that date is not just a coincidence. Franklin couldn't do anything until that manumission of an enslaved person, essentially that was purchased in America, was accomplished. Once that was accomplished, then everything starts cascading very rapidly. The Hutchinson letters were already in his possession, and those were letters that had been written from the royal governor of Massachusetts and the vice governor of Massachusetts, telling the British government secretly that they had to keep a military presence in Boston and New York simply to keep the colonists from thinking that they were truly British. Said he to abridge their British rights is the terminology he used. So that would also inflame, as we talked about, both Boston and New York, because it simply said that the reason for the British military to still be present in their colonies was to act as a police force against them. Wow. Once we've got the Somerset decision, then Franklin leaks those letters to the Boston press. And of course, the Bostonians go wild. You're already familiar with the two Adams cousins, Samuel and John. Samuel immediately jumps into this and starts talking about the treachery of the royal governor of Massachusetts and how could he do this? And that's why we're having people killed in our streets. And of course, the Bostonians, they don't need a whole lot of prodding. And they immediately leave the South meeting house in early December of 1773, where there are four British ships sitting in Boston Harbor loaded with tea that's being taxed heavily to the American colonists. And they board the ships and start dumping the tea in Boston Harbor. And we all know that story. That's the Boston Party. And that came specifically because Franklin had leaked those letters to the Boston press. The British respond with the coercive acts, as they are known in Great Britain. For Americans, we know them forever as the intolerable acts. There were five government laws against the American colonists that essentially bankrupted Boston. That just stirred the pot that much more. Mm-hmm. And when we get Lexington and Concord, by that point, the rock's rolling down the hill quickly, and we have an American Revolution. And all of that was done at the insistence of Benjamin Franklin, simply to free Pennsylvania.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot to do just for one specific. Wow.
A lot.
So my question, well, I've got a lot of questions, but my first question, were the Bostonians angry at the actual wanting of the abolitionists in England to free a slave? Were they against that? Or was it that they saw England interfering with American colony business?
The northern colonies really didn't care about abolition at the time. They didn't necessarily like it. John Adams was stridently opposed to slavery. But at that time, most of the Massachusetts founding fathers were more interested in preserving a union of colonies. And if that's what it took to keep the southern colonies involved, people like the Adams cousins were willing to just simply hold their noses and keep their mouths shut when they dealt directly with the southern founding fathers. That really wasn't their fight. Their fight was more, as you've indicated, the ongoing pressure on the part of the British government to keep the colonists in New York and Massachusetts under their thumb and tape policy. The Bostonians and the New York Patriots all were asserting their right to be represented in Parliament. You know, this whole issue of not allowing taxation without representation in Parliament. And that's what they wanted, was they wanted to be treated as equals to the Brits in London and in Manchester and in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. From the London side, they were laughing in their faces. It's like, you people aren't British. You people are colonists. You people are second-class citizens, and you're never going to be represented in Parliament.
Right.
Shut up and do your jobs.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, because the loyalists are considering themselves British citizens, even though they're in the Americas, and they feel like they should still have some sort of say over there. And then Britain's like, no, you made your bed. You know, you wanted to go all the way across the ocean and do all this. So we're still going to be in charge of you, but you have absolutely no say in our affairs.
Sure. And for the American reader today, sometimes it's helpful to understand that at that point, the British government was still being run by the House of Lords and not the Commons. The House of Lords was dictating all policy in Great Britain. So this was the nobility.
Yeah.
The firstborn sons of firstborn sons of firstborn sons, whereas the American colonists were the third and fourthborn sons. Mm-hmm. Essentially had no say. These were the little brothers and little sisters that couldn't make a go of it in Great Britain, so they had to go to the American colonies, and that's how they were looked upon by the British government, which essentially were the nobility.
So Franklin goes to London. He finds out about this case, and he uses that kind of as like this red flag that he waves in front of the southern colonists, like, look what's going to happen if we don't break away. But he's really, I don't want to put judgment on a historical figure, but it kind of very self-serving.
It is horribly self-serving. Yeah. It is horribly self-serving. You know, we're re-releasing the book at the end of this month. And one of the things that I've done with that, a lot more research, a lot more effort, you know, a lot of pushback on the initial thesis of the book and premise of the book. And what we are really coming to realize now is once Franklin went to London, he was in essence radicalized in the course of 20 years. And by 1776, when he comes back to participate in the Second Continental Congress, the people that thought they knew who he was don't recognize him. He's who is this radical? Who is this person that speaks of revolution in every sentence? It's like, really? I thought this guy was a printer and a postmaster. Mm-hmm. Like, so Franklin is willing to use whatever it takes. We fortunately, since I wrote the book, I was brought to my attention another book that your listeners need to be aware of called The Common Cause by Robert Parkinson. He's on the faculty at Binghamton University in New York. And he points out in an interlude in his book that Franklin was actually charged by the American government in 1777 to promote essentially a book of pictures for children of atrocities committed by Black Americans against white settlers and indigenous people against white settlers, including bludgeoning children to death and engaging in rape of white women. And, you know, and Franklin takes this cause on very willingly and is excited about it, and even enlists Lafayette in this project in terms of artists in France that are willing to do this. And it's a horrible story. It's like Benjamin Franklin is almost losing his mind over this whole radicalization problem. In some ways, I think we're fortunate in the United States that Franklin was so old that his age tended to temper his zeal. God only knows where we would have been otherwise.
Right. Could you imagine? Could you imagine if he was a young man?
Yeah, I mean, it was like indigenous people aren't people. Enslaved Black Africans are not really people. And that was Franklin's stance.
Yeah.
Throughout that whole time.
And this is, I can't even do the math, 250 years.
250 years. We haven't been aware of this story. And as I keep telling people on the heels of Kamau Bell's new book coming out on, we need to talk about Cosby. Well, readers, listeners, we really need to have a chat about Benjamin Franklin. Mm-hmm. That's really where this book is opening a chapter, is we really need to have a chat about who Benjamin Franklin was.
Right.
Some great things for the United States. He did some tremendous things for Philadelphia, but at the same time, he was certainly no saint.
Right. And it's funny that you say that, because if you come to, you know, something like this, or you come to a conversation like this with just your basic knowledge that you have from school, right? From elementary school or, you know, junior high school or something. What did Benjamin Franklin do? Didn't he tie a key to a kite?
Are you there?
Right. I think he had these little crazy glasses, you know, he's on the $100 bill. What do we know? We literally come out of school knowing very little about history. And it's things like this, like books like this, that's opening these doors or these rabbit holes, actually, that we're going to fall down into. Because we're finding out, again, 250 years later, we're finding out about the origination of our country, or, you know, our past is not as pretty and rosy as, you know, as we've been taught to believe.
Not at all.
It's sad that it took this long, for one. And it's also disheartening how unknowledgeable, how dumb we are about our own history, you know?
Yes. The 32nd chapter of the book talks about the effort that Franklin put forth in 1782 and 1783. By that time, the American Revolution was pretty much a done deal. Yorktown was already passed. The British government was already making strong overtures to Franklin to settle this either with the French involved, or actually they preferred to settle it without the French involved, interestingly enough. But it was pretty much a done deal. And at that point, Franklin deliberately starts destroying evidence. Mm. Burning massive amounts of paperwork, instructing his colleagues in London to do the same. Interestingly enough, his acolyte and protege, Thomas Paine, trust me, Thomas Paine was fully radicalized and educated by Benjamin Franklin for that purpose. And Payne refuses to do this. Payne kept his whole catalog of all the letters and all the papers that had been exchanged between Benjamin Franklin and his inner circle, his cabal, if you will, in London, and carefully preserved that until the end of his life. And it strongly urged the people that he left it with to catalog it all and make sure it got published.
And this is how we find out. This is the information that trickles down and we find out.
No, we don't have a single page of it.
Oh, gosh.
Destroyed in a warehouse fire in St. Louis, Missouri in 1843.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
Well, as gross as the story is and how self-serving, as we said, it is, to me, bittersweet to know that there was at least one person in Britain that was concerned with equality amongst humankind, right? One person at that stage in history. It's bittersweet because it's still such a problem now with the equality, right? I mean, that's a whole other show we can talk about. But in 1772, it's little less than 100 years before what, the 13th Amendment and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes.
June 19th.
You know, yes, all those things are 90 years hence. Yes.
But it was a known thing. It was a kernel of an idea 90 years before.
And only that. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, Granville Sharp, the man that was pressing for the ultimate freeing of James Somerset, himself fervently believed that Black Africans were not the equivalent of whites.
What did he get out of this?
He felt that chattel slavery was hurting not only Blacks, but whites. And he watched enslavers in terms of their moral degradation, in terms of how they behaved. And that story is told repeatedly by people that were eyewitnesses before 1830 in the British Empire and before 1865 in the United States, watching what happened to enslavers in terms of their own behavior, their interactions with other people once they embarked upon ownership of human beings. And they said almost invariably, they became kind of morally bankrupt. They started doing things that they never would have done before. They started behaving in ways, even with other whites, that they never would have done before. And so Granville Sharp said, this is just a human corruption is what this is. And he wanted it stopped. Interestingly enough, there was an abolitionist in Philadelphia at that time that was an acquaintance of Benjamin Franklin throughout almost his entire life, who did fervently believe and could actually prove that Black students and indigenous students in his little school in Philadelphia in 1750 were just as smart as the white kids. He said, some of my best students are Black, some of my best students are indigenous people. He said, they're the same as you and me. And that man's name is Anthony Benezet. And we're trying to resurrect some of these true heroes.
Yeah.
Sharp was a hero in his own right, but the true hero, if you want a hero in this story, is Anthony Benezet. And why don't Americans know that name?
Right, exactly.
He made Martin Luther King look like a piker by comparison. I mean, this man literally was a walking saint. He was literally a Mother Teresa.
Wow.
50 years before that.
And for the, despite everything else, just for the mere fact that he was not afraid to say it.
Absolutely not. Wow. And wouldn't contest it in his presence. He said, come into my school, I'll show you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have his students of African origin stand up and read for anybody that wanted to come to the school and listen. And
Wow. Yeah,
they'd read chapters of the Bible. And people would just look at them like, how can they do this? Because they're people.
Yeah.
Human beings.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So this guy in London, Sharp, right? I feel like he looked at the owning of slaves and what it, like you said, what it did to the people that owned slaves, almost as if they were a vice. So freeing of the slaves would be like removing alcohol from the home. Like it's going to improve their moral character if it's removed. So it wasn't necessarily altruistic. It was, let me help my white brother be better kind of thing.
There was a lot of that in Granville Sharp.
Yeah.
A lot of that in him. He, you know, he didn't, he wasn't a bigot by any means. You know, he brought Black Africans into his own home. And, you know, as we talked about in the book, he, James Somerset, while he was still an enslaved person, found shelter in the home of Granville Sharp. And Granville Sharp was more than happy to do this, to provide this service. But if you had asked Granville Sharp whether he's the exact same thing as a philosopher like David Hume in terms of intellect, he would have said, no way. In that regard, Granville Sharp was wrong, but he was a man of his times.
Right.
Thomas Jefferson, that he would have said, no, they're not. Thomas Jefferson never believed that Black Americans were the intellectual equivalent of white Americans. I mean, that was the white man of the 18th century.
Yeah.
Anthony Benezet really stands out as maybe the most enlightened person of the entire 18th century. And as you said, he may be the one that stood alone. That's why I even brought him up, was you had somebody standing alone. Anthony Benezet is your guy.
We need some Anthony Benezets nowadays.
We could use a couple million of them.
Yeah, for sure. Oh gosh. So all of this is going on just because, I mean, it all boils down to Franklin not wanting Philadelphia to fall. Was it pride? Because you said it was the second biggest.
Yeah, it was pride. It was a love for Philadelphia. The man was absolutely, you know, he was not born in Philadelphia. He was born in Boston. He had never set foot in Philadelphia until he was 17 years old. But it was in Philadelphia that he found shelter. He was at that point an unfree person himself. He was essentially a white slave. Mm-hmm. Came to Philadelphia. And there he found shelter. There he found the ability to make an independent living, amass a significant amount of wealth. And he felt a sense of tremendous loyalty throughout his entire life to Philadelphia. Philadelphia to him was the center of the universe, and he was going to do everything he could to make sure it maintained its prominence in the British Empire.
So for, was it 15 years? 15 years he did all of this?
Over the course of about 15 years, yes. He first went to London in 1757 and then came back for a short period of time, about 1763. But by 1764, he's back in Great Britain again and will not be back in the U.S. until 1775, after pretty much, as we talked about, the ball's already rolling down the hill.
Wow. And this ball is setting off the revolution.
Correct.
Wow. Man, we don't learn this in school.
No. And the story doesn't end there, because Franklin immediately starts manipulating the Second Continental Congress to make sure that he becomes the minister, essentially the ambassador to France, because that's where he's arranging the financing of the American Revolution. And he's already made these arrangements. So he needs a cover to make it look like this is something that he's coming up with off the spur of the moment, whereas right. It's been set up long since. So his entire presence in France was a manipulation of his as well. And he continues to serve the American government right up to the end of his life.
Wow. Now, again, I'm not a history buff, but the French were a friend to America during the Revolution, right?
They were coaxed into becoming a friend of the American. Initially, they were smarting. They had been defeated twice within 10 years in wars against Great Britain, and they had lost significant territory in their colonies. They had lost a lot of world prestige. They were hurting. And if there was any way that they could get back at Great Britain, they were certainly willing to listen. And when Franklin brought this proposal to them, they said, well, tell us some more about this. And the more they talked about it, the more they said, this isn't going to work. You guys are going to all get executed in London. You're all going to be hanged. This is just treason. This is rebellion against the crown. And this is the most powerful military in the world. You guys are going to lose just like we lost. Mm-hmm. We're France, and we just lost two wars against this military. And then you guys, this rabble from America, is going to go after this same military. Mm-hmm. You slaughtered. And Franklin said, okay, let's produce you a military victory in the American colonies, and then I'll come and call you again. I'll come knocking on your doors. And that was Saratoga. Mm-hmm. Saratoga was delivered to George Washington by Benjamin Franklin. He said, here's what's coming down. He gave Washington 6 months advance warning. He said, this is where this is coming down. There's a British army that's going to be coming down from Canada. They're going to try to cut off the Hudson River so that Massachusetts is isolated. And then they're going to crush Massachusetts like a bug. Hmm. He said, so they're going to be coming down from Canada. We need to make sure that we don't have any military presence coming from New York City. We need to isolate that army, and we can choke them off, essentially surround them and choke them off in central New York. Mm-hmm. The designated site for doing that, Saratoga, New York.
Wow.
At that point, the French said, tell us some more about this revolution. At that point, they opened up the coffers. And so we finally had financial support that was so desperately needed to make this happen.
Right. I mean, it brings to mind a couple, I don't know if allegory is a word I want, but it's kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right?
There.
And also there's and I'm going to make a pop culture reference. There's a scene in the first Avengers movie where New York, the city of New York, is under attack by the aliens and Loki and whatnot. And Captain America says to the police officer, you know, I need people on these buildings. You take them down put a perimeter, you know, he fires off these orders. The police officer is like, why should I listen to you? And then, you know, something happens and he instantly repeats, you know, we need to get the perimeters. So you kind of had to see that the person that, you know, oh, they did push back the British. They did defeat them. Okay. Well, maybe they're not going to get quite as slaughtered as we thought they would.
Yeah,
they might still, but you know,
but might as well speak. But this gives us a chance to get back at Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And that's when the French said, we're in, because if we can get back at Great Britain, if we can somehow win this thing, mm-hmm. get our territory back, we can get French Canada back, we can get more territory in Canada, mm-hmm. British government, we can get some of our colonies in the West Indies back again. This is going to reestablish us as a world power. And that's when France was all in on this. Right. One of the things that we forget is that Benjamin Franklin was perhaps one of the most influential people outside of the United States in the entire 18th century. If you had flagged down a man on the streets in 1765 in anywhere in Europe, pick a site, and asked them to name an American colonist, 98% of them would have said, Benjamin Franklin. He was the only colonist they knew. Mm-hmm. And intellectual abilities with his flying kites and rainstorms and focal glasses and developing a new heating system with the Franklin stove, he was kind of the Albert Einstein, if you will, of the 18th century. He was considered this blindingly brilliant man. He was a printer. Poor Richard's Almanac in the 1740s was one of the best-selling books in Paris. So all through Europe, it was like, this guy is a media star. And so it wasn't just anybody that was knocking on the door in Paris, France. It was Benjamin Franklin.
Right.
Like, this guy might know what he's talking about.
Yeah. We've heard of him.
Everything. Yeah, we know him, and he's not done so well with everything else. Maybe he's got to get the Brits.
Wow. We are learning today. We are learning today. I mean, I'm just gobsmacked by how little we're taught. And I don't know if it's
Is it a time crunch because you only, you know, your teacher only has you for an hour a day? Is it because of the school books and who's written them? Are they too old?
Yeah. You're getting much closer.
Yeah.
The story, like I said, it was suppressed in Franklin's own lifetime.
Wow.
By 1790, I think people were realizing this is a terrible story. It's a horrible story. We talked about this in the last chapter, that when you look back on this, it's terrible. What Benjamin Franklin was doing was he was politicizing the relationship between whites and Black African enslaved persons. He was politicizing the relationship between whites and indigenous persons. He didn't care. He was totally unapologetic about it because it was part of his aim and the only way that he could see to achieve what he wanted. And I think once people calmed him down after the Americans had signed their independence, he looked back on it and thought, what was I thinking? Why did I do this? He actually becomes an abolitionist of sorts. He becomes the first president of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. He makes Philadelphia a seat of freedom for escaped enslaved persons. That goes on right into the Underground Railroad.
Wow.
Frederick Douglass, his target when he escaped in Maryland, he said, I've got to get to Philadelphia.
Hmm.
Harriet Tubman said, I've got to get to Philadelphia. That wasn't a coincidence. That was all Franklin's work as well, but he was a very repentant abolitionist. It was like, I'm going to hell.
Oh, no.
It's amazing.
Last Hail Mary.
It's amazing what some of our more famous Americans start doing at the end of their lives. It's amazing what the Cornelius Vanderbilts and the John D. Rockefellers, the barons of the 1880s do at the end of their lives when they realize, oh my God, I'm going to hell. And all of a sudden, you get the Vanderbilt Foundation, you get the Rockefeller Foundation. It's like, I got to give all this stuff away.
Oh my gosh.
The same way. Oh my gosh, I got to do something for the enslaved people of the American colonies, now the American states. And he does.
After I used them, after I used their plight for my own advantages. Oh wow. That's crazy to me, but it also makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and this is why I wrote the book. Because I felt just like you're feeling right now. I got ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to just any schools. I went to Northwestern University for undergrad. I went for graduate school to the University of Southern California. I heard none of this. Mm-hmm. History major by any means, but I heard none of this from anybody. These stories simply weren't there. I stumbled into this story. I stumbled into it reading one of these bizarre little books about things you never knew about the American Revolution, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And they were talking about Somerset versus Stuart, and I'd never heard of it. And so that's when I did, like all red-blooded Americans, I went to Wiki.
Mm-hmm.
Somerset versus Stuart, and I was gobsmacked. I was stunned. And then I started looking, they said, this is considered, probably not, but this is considered a potential motivator for the American Revolution, as well as the Hutchinson Papers. I did not know about those. So I started reading about that. And then all of a sudden, everything starts pointing to one person. And they were both pointing almost with neon signs, Benjamin Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, Benjamin Franklin. That's when I had to do my own homework.
Right.
What in the heck's going on?
Right. And it's so strange, like when you look at reviews for the books, for your book, it's like polar opposite. People are like, I learned so much. This is so, well researched. This is, and then other ones are like, and I'm a cynical person, and other reviews are like, there's no historical blah, blah, blah to back this up. And I'm like, well, you're a racist, obviously. So I feel like it would fall like that way. It would fall into those halves.
It does. Yeah. It does. And that was one of the motivators for bringing out the revised edition. For your readers or listeners that are hearing this, don't buy it right now. the new one's coming out at the end of the month. Wait for that one. It's going to launch on Amazon. It will launch on my website, which is Phil Goodrich Author, philgoodrichauthor.com. That one, I accepted those criticisms. I went back, more fully annotated the book. I've looked at contemporary history books coming out, and they are looking for 1,500 footnotes. This one now has over 1,400 footnotes. It's there.
Wow.
I've added four appendixes, including talking about the radicalization of Benjamin Franklin. It's there. It's ironclad. And now, due to a very astute reader that chastised me a month after my book came out, she said, "You historians never do your homework."
Oh, no.
To look into Benjamin Franklin's connection to Somerset versus Stuart. And when I did that more intensively, I about fell out of my chair, because she was absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Franklin manipulated Somerset versus Stuart. He manipulated that court decision. It turns out that that court decision was more along the lines of the Rosa Parks decision. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the Rosa Parks. I know you almost certainly know the story.
Right.
Refusing to go to the back of the bus. But what a lot of people aren't aware of is that Rosa Parks at that time was the president of her local chapter of the NAACP. And she had staged that entire thing to bring that to the attention of the American people and to produce the court case. I don't know.
Did we learn that in school? I don't think so.
We did get that out at the end of Rosa Parks' life. That they were pointing that out, that was done on purpose. People say, well, so that was just fake. No, it wasn't fake. The reason that we stage trials anywhere, including in London or in the United States, is because at that point you get your perfect case. You to have it like shrouded by, well, but she had, you know, done this, she had yelled at somebody, or she was misbehaving. So they needed somebody that had behaved perfectly getting on that bus. Mm-hmm. And when the driver said, "You need to move to the back," they needed somebody that didn't like smack him or spit on him or something like that. They needed to behave perfectly and say, "No, I'm sitting here." And when that bus driver reacted violently and grabbed her and threw her off the bus, she couldn't like whack him with her purse or anything like that. She had to behave perfectly. Now you've got a case that the courts can't say, "Oh, well, he did that because she hit him," or
right.
So he was antagonizing passengers. Mm-hmm. So you get a perfect case that way. That right. They got with Somerset versus Stuart. They needed a perfect case. The Chief Justice needed it. Granville Sharp needed it. Benjamin Franklin needed it. So they staged it.
Wow. And with Rosa Parks, it's kind of a case of peaceful provocation to bring attention to the plight.
Exactly. Yeah. When you do civil disobedience, this goes right back to Henry David Thoreau. And when you do civil disobedience, you have to do it correctly. And so many of our people that want to do civil disobedience don't do it correctly because they forget the last two parts of it. You have to be arrested for it, and you can't protest against it with any violence. You have to accept whatever your punishment is.
Well, that's the way to get your message across. I mean,
that's how it works. That's the name of the game. That's Gandhi writ large.
Right. Well, yeah, because I mean, the violent eruptions protest or, you know, wars, they do get the bigger headlines. They do. But
they ruin the cause.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's crazy. Well, oh God, we're running out of time. It has been a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. And I want everybody to, did you say Phil Goodrich or Philip Goodrich?
It's Phil, because then we don't have to worry about the two L's or one L.
Right.
Google told me that right off the bat. They said, if you're concerned about making sure people get it correct, just do Phil. So philgoodrichauthor.com.
And also amazon.com.
Correct.
And that's going to be at the end of February, you said?
Yes, ma'am. It is indeed. We're excited about it, as you can tell.
Yes. Well, February is a good month as well. There's a lot going on with the.
It is Black History Month. It's also American History Month.
Mm-hmm. I believe not yesterday. I don't even know what day we're on. The 3rd. February 1st was Freedom Day, right? Is that right?
Yes. Outside of Boston, which
I don't fly about. Yeah. I'm in Boston.
April 15th.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, there's a lot going on. So everybody should definitely pick up the book. It's very good. I'm going to pass it on to my dad after he is more of a buff than I. He will enjoy this. He will enjoy seeing and reading and learning.
For those who read it with an open mind, at the end they say, now the American Revolution makes sense. They all knock in their chair and say, because the story makes no sense without this.
Right.
And we talk about that in the preface. I would just encourage any readers that are going to get the book, please read the preface, the author's notes. Please read the whole thing. And even look in the footnotes. I reward you with some silliness in the footnotes if you just go to the trouble.
Yep. It is definitely recommended reading, just because if you ask me, a grown-up, what was the American Revolution about? Well, we wanted to be our own country. Britain didn't really want to let us. And then we threw some tea in the harbor. And I don't consider myself a stupid person, but honestly, unless you...
Sense.
Yeah. Why did we throw the tea in the harbor? I have no idea. Taxation without, without causation or representation. Yeah. So it's like a lot of times, unless you delve into things as you have done, you only know what you were taught and what you learned in a textbook that was written by a white Christian straight man.
Correct.
You know, 100 years ago, however long
correct.
It was.
So, 200 years ago. Yes.
Yeah. Well, so kudos to you, because it's a very good book, and I'm very excited to get the revision later at the end of the month. After that, what's up next?
Had two things thrown at me. I think one the clock's running on, and that is the story from my own high school in Missouri of a young basketball coach 2 years after the integration of the schools, taking a basketball team to the state championship in Missouri. That's going to make Remember the Titans and Hoosiers look minor league by comparison. It's a story, and a lot of my sports listeners will know this coach's name. His name was Gene Bartow, now in the College Basketball Hall of Fame.
Oh wow! Okay.
This was his first coaching. This was his first coaching job in 1957. And the reason the clock's running is I just learned in the last 6 months that several of these players are still living.
Oh wow! Okay.
Very interested in telling their story.
And which university was this? Was this
Missouri? This was at St. Charles High School.
Oh, high school even.
High school in St. Charles, Missouri, winning their state basketball championship.
Oh, that's crazy!
It's a great story.
I look forward to that.
Absolutely. It's a great story.
Yeah, you better get on it.
I got to get on it while I still got these eyewitnesses.
You're right, exactly. Oh, wow. So are you going to do it kind of in like an interview?
Absolutely. We're going to talk with them. I'm going to give them the background that I'm aware of and, you know, ask them, fill in the blanks.
Fill in the blanks, yeah.
What did I get wrong? What did I get right? What was it like being thrown together? This was 2 years after St. Charles, Missouri closed their African-American high school and essentially forced all of those students into their white schools. Wow. It was like, and they had two African-American basketball players on that team, and both of those two young men were All-State that season. Wow. And the only All-State players on that team, and Gene Bartow put that team together.
That's amazing.
Exactly. That's got to be a great story there.
Absolutely. I can't wait to read it. Well, Philip, it has been an absolute pleasure and honor talking with you. Please keep in touch.
I'll do that. And thank you so much for this opportunity. It means the world to me.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an amazing book. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for educating me. At my age to now know what a little more about the American Revolution and this.
Say nothing of it by age.
All righty. Well, Philip, you have a wonderful night, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this creative conversation. Please head over to beunique.org. Like, follow, and support my lovely human beings over there. You can find me on all social media. I am Pup Duffy on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. You can follow and like the show on Facebook. It's Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. If you like the music you're hearing, head over to RaleighKeegan.com. You can purchase a physical CD. You can download digital content. You can keep up to date with tour dates and new releases. It's RaleighKeegan.com. And please be sure to visit my sponsor, Newsly.me, for all of your news needs. You can listen to podcasts there like mine. As always, take care of each other, love each other, watch each other's backs, and I'll see you next time.